Yeah, off there's as you all know, Broadway, so there's some off-Broadway, which is plays, which theater is just a little smaller than Broadway theaters, and off-Broadway is even smaller. Now, the one big production I had was three of my one acts were done in an off-Broadway theater that happened to be only half a block from Broadway. So it didn't feel that far away. You could see where it goes.
Thank you. I don't know how many of you have heard this part of the story, but today is my 50th birthday.
And this reading was planned by my wife without my knowledge. And on Friday I was reading the Irish Times, and I started looking for what we're going to be doing over the next week, and saw myself listed in the Irish Times, and I figured, what are the odds of there being another poet in Ireland? It was just a moment where I thought, well, no, you know. About 20 years ago, I met a young Irish poet named Colm Walsh, and he recited a little poem by Petra Kavanagh, Innocence, by heart, and then recited his translation of it into Gaelic. And I'd never heard of Patrick Kavanagh, and that was the beginning of my love of Patrick Kavanagh's work. So this is Innocence by Patrick Kavanagh. But first I'm going to breathe a little. They laughed at what I loved, the triangular hill that hung under the big forest. They said that I was bounded by the white thorn hedges of the little farm and did not know the world. But I knew that love's doorway to life was the same doorway everywhere. Ashamed of what I loved, I flung her from me and called her a ditch, although she was smiling at me with violence. But now I am back in her briary arms. The dew of an Indian summer morning sits on bleached potato stalks. What age am I? I am no mortal age. I know nothing of women, nothing of cities. I cannot die unless I step outside these white thorn hedges. I don't know the Gaelic translation. So that was the beginning of my reading of Patrick Kavanagh. When I was in high school, I used to go to the library in my lunch period and use the entire lunch period to just browse through a book. And then when there was 10 minutes left, I would get a pass to go to the cafeteria and eat my lunch. And so I would use 40 minutes of the 50-minute period to browse through the shelves. And as I was saying, poetry was pretty poorly taught in the States, as is, I think, almost everywhere, unfortunately. So I was kind of self-teaching myself. And the lesson process was just a matter of pulling out books and standing in the aisle and reading. And if something struck me, I would sit down and read further. And if by the end of the period I was still interested, I would take the book out. And one of the poems I found was Yeats' Second Coming. I was, I think, 15 or 16, and I didn't really understand it. I'm not sure I still do, but I certainly didn't understand it at 15. But I also knew that there was something that it was doing with the language and the imagery and the power. It was something it was telling me something powerful. And it's one of the poems that when I was in high school, when I was that young, just starting to write, that became just one of those tuning forks. You know, there's certain poems that are just doing something, they just say, that's just what poems can do, this is what I want to do with my life. And that was one of those poems. So since I'm in Ireland, I'm starting with Kavanagh, this is the second poem. Turning and turning in the winding gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely, some revelation is at hand. Surely, the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow signs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert burn. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born.
I just, about halfway through that, I thought,
that's what we taught in every school in Ireland. Is that true? Is it when you studied that in high school? Awesome. I thought we may have picked the wrong place to be reciting from memory that poem. I thought, if I screw it up anyway, they won't be here. Somebody in this room is going to know. The chapbook that Paul mentioned is called Genesis. And I'm going to read a couple of poems from that. When Abraham built an altar. Excuse me. And Abraham built an altar. I actually lost my watch. Can someone keep track of the time? I'm not sure what the time is. Or what the time limit is for that one.
Sure. We're going to play it by ear.
Okay.
No strict.
This is much nicer than my watch was.
Happy birthday.
And Abraham built an altar. Everything had gone as he'd imagined over and over since that night the boys had asked him this. As always, the boys did not begrudge him anything, had not complained of the early awakening, the long trek, the high climb, had been quick to, And Abraham built an altar. Everything had gone as he'd imagined over and over it would since that night the boys had asked him this. As always, the boys did not begrudge him anything, had not complained of the early awakening, the long trek, the high climb, had been quick to gather brambles, had chosen the stone and wet the night, had never asked after the missing ram, sensitive to his old father's dread of senility. And now the morning crew of two dry sticks rubbing together, and the boy crouched over, patient for the flame, his back to his father, who tests and retests the hemp in his hands. He was the envy of all the other fathers, who complained of surly and lazy sons. His boy was the beauty of all the boys, the girls in the tribe dreamt of being his. How could the voice that had promised this son ask him this? Wasn't it possible this once it had erred, this once would forgive his doubt? But this was the voice that had promised him great flocks, promised him sweet wells, promised him king, promised him everything he now called his, he would kill the boy. This is in three sections. I don't think I have to do anything to indicate the transitions, and I think they should kind of just keep it work, I hope. It's called, In Sorrow Shalt Thou Bring Forth Children. She lays my palm with a child in her belly, swims toward birth, as if eager to get there. Where, here, where we wander from moment to moment, wondering, is this the only moment I'm alive in? Looking for connections to string our days into a pattern we can finger and admire. Looking for something older and brighter than who we are, to offer up our making, to keep it burning after our last light closes. But it is we who will burn. The fire does not wait for us, does not ask for any offering. It takes, makes flesh ash, can no more thank or praise what it burns than a flame can the twig it blackens. What world would be now had Isaac fled or fought his father? Had Jesus whipped the centurions at Gethsemane instead of petty merchants in his father's house? Abraham's hand was stayed by God, and Christ's torn temple in 3 days stood, but no hand stayed, no Jesus rebuilt, the body singing in formation to the sacrifice. There was no time to bury the bodies, no time. When the shelling stopped, we dragged the dead to the nearest pit, threw in dirt, fled when the shelling resumed. And in the blast, the dead rose up again and pelted the living with lumps of rotted flesh. The strongest, bravest, most beautiful youth was chosen from the tribe and, dizzy with drums, disemboweled, what shook out from his body, shaken out over the field. And when the crops came, red flowers found between the corn were carried to his mother as proof the gods had blessed her loss. Across the field where stone crosses flower, a box of ribbons and medals are carried to the dead soldier's mother. Against my palm, the future made flesh. Already fighting to be alive, to be alive. And if I take you to the mountain, to the hill of skulls, and bid you gather wood to build an altar or a cross, before I have the chance to bind you, even as I promise that you cannot die, that you will arise. Have the courage to defy or flee or slay me.
I think I know this one.
Happy. In the States we have something called the Baltimore Catechism.
Have you sat here? Probably not.
You know the Baltimore Catechism? No, oh, the Baltimore Catechism is maybe completely obsolete. It was a little booklet with prayers and questions and answers that you had to memorize. It's a good Catholic child. Excuse me. So it was all in the form of questions and answers. One of the questions was, why did God make man? And the answer was, God made man to know him, to love him, and to serve him in this world, and to be happy with him forever in heaven. Now the, so that's what I learned in the 1960s. The new person says,
because
he is Eve. Why did God make us? God made us. See, they took the sex and language out somewhere in the last 30, 40 years. This is called Happy. It's in three sections. It's about my Irish Catholic childhood in Jersey City, which is a small working class city on New York Harbor. Just opposite here, where I grew up. Three sections, I think a pause will make the transitions between the whole story being told pretty clear. Happy. Also, I don't know if you noticed, in the States, there's a racist expression, guinea, for someone who's Italian. You heard this? Someone who's Italian is called a guinea in the States. Who won't be that person? When I was a kid, it was an expression that was used. I've never taught. One, the Buddha sees the infinite suffering of the world and must laugh. And so must Vinny the skinny guinea Philippon, who, if someone tripped in confirmation class, would laugh so hard he'd shake like a scarecrow in a windstorm. Fall down a flight of stairs, he'd be so spastic with laughter he'd fall down right on top of you, near ecstatic with delight at his own bumps and bruises. Draw blood? Forget it. He'd have to clutch his crotch and run mock-meat to the boys' room, begging every being in the known and unknown universe, please, please don't make me laugh. And Father Burke never thought he was enlightened. Two. That's right, Jesus said to turn the other cheek. But what do you say about some punk who just keeps picking on you and your pals? We looked away as Father Burke flooded Vinny's nose with Kleenex. Nothing. You know why? Because even Jesus understood. Some people can't be reached with kindness. You get hit once, you let it slide. You get hit twice, you take the SOB out back and clean the spot. When Father Mills, the cool priest, the one who smoked in class, and loved to watch his still-lit cigarette tumble the four stories to the sidewalk and never hit anyone, came to give us future altar boys special religious instruction, we asked what we thought impossible questions like, if God can do anything, can he make a wall too high for him to climb? Because if he can't build it or can't climb over, he can't do everything. He'd answer that we were thinking on an earthly plane while the mind of God was boundless, which Kevin McGinty explicated for us as, nah, he can't do it. When we ask, can God sin? Because if he's all good, he can't do evil. And if he can't do evil, he can't do everything. He asks us, can you make a universe? A solar system? A planet? How about a grain of sand? Well, actually, Father, Kevin began, with an ostentatiously obsequious smirk that signaled to the rest of us he was about to outsmart a grown-up. Once, me and Vinny Philippon, that's Vinny Philippon and I. Once, Vinny Philippon and I were smashing cinder blocks. That doesn't count. That sand already existed. I made from nothingness. Can you make a grain of sand from nothing? No. Not even one tiny grain. Then how can you expect to understand the mind that created everything, the entire universe? You, trying to think like God, is like an insect trying to think like you. Once you've left this earth, if you ever get to heaven, McGinty. You'll understand. Which was a Dominican's way of saying, shut up and drop dead, you little bug. Thank you. This is called life. It's a very modest poem. The title has an epigraph. It's from Bruce Springsteen. You get used to anything, sooner or later, it just becomes your life. Life. With soap, steam, steel, we scrape our bodies clean at the altar of water, as if chlorine and alcohol were holy vapors, could make us eternal. But a hole in the earth receives the earth from a hole in our bodies. We shit, shower, and shave our way into another day. We are good soldiers, salute the dawn with coffee and cigarettes, and name the silent desperation infusing all our acts, the daily grind. Another day, we smile and shrug, another dollar. But never say, each day we wake to the feast of our lives, lift our hands to eat and find they stink a little. Not so anyone would notice. Just enough to shame us for ever believing we might deserve this feast. We, who cannot even wash ourselves. It's not that life is like a lover who betrays us, but one whose love we never quite believe in. And so we look away, look towards heaven, look anywhere but at whatever requires devotion. We know the earth loves us. Has felt its numberless kisses in the small rain. Know it desires us. Have felt its mud tongue. I'm sorry, I lost my place. That's all for myself.
It doesn't seem to be where it should be. Damn it.
I'm gonna try it again. Life. With soap, steam, steel, we scrape our bodies clean at the altar of water, as if chlorine and alcohol were holy vapors, could make us eternal. But a hole in the earth receives the earth from a hole in our bodies. We shit, shower, and shave our way into another day. We are good soldiers. Salute the dawn with coffee and cigarettes, and name the quiet desperation infusing all our acts, the daily grind. Another day, we smile and shrug, another dollar. But never say, each day we wake to the feast of our lives, lift our hands to eat and find they stink a little. Not so anyone would notice, just enough to shame us for ever believing we might deserve this feast. We who cannot even wash ourselves. It's not that life is like a lover who... Oh my God. It's not that life is like a lover who... It's not that life is like a lover who... It's not that life, it's not the lover who refuses us, but one whose love we never quite believe in. And so we look away, look toward heaven, look anywhere but at whatever requires devotion. We know the earth loves us, have felt its numberless kisses in the small rain, know it desires us, will thrust its mud tongue between our toes, into our ears, our clefts, is our one eternal love who will merge with us completely. And for this, we curse it, scraping our soul against the curb in a clumsy purification dance, as if we could be separate from dirt, and Jesus didn't vanish into earth. I think it is finished. I think so. What else was he supposed to do? What better symbol for eternity and now as one than a cross made up of the intersecting lines of the endless fixed horizon and the daily transit of the sun. And the ritual, one they acted out in countless variations. He lets them kill him, kill their God upon the tree of life. And still, they will not understand. What is eternal is what dies. But to die with your arms open wide, to forgive no matter what. Oh, is that all? He should have known that anything is easier than love. Call down the stairway after me. Hold me again in your voice. Even uncombed and sleepy eyes, reminding me we need milk and bread. You lean out over me like light that comes leaning in summer windows, open towards green lakes, where dragonflies vibrate, intense as the air between kisses. Meet me each morning on the stairway, in a robe clutched close at your waist. Newspapers, orange juice, ask me for anything, if I can live in a moment like this.
Lucky for you, I've got my tap shoes. Okay, I'll revisit this. Okay. besides it, there's this little Michael. I'll have to keep it up.
Okay. This is a couple of summers ago. There was a little kind of gathering at my house. I learned the reading for three poets. The one was an Irish American poet named Joe Wild, who's a wonderful, brilliant performer, who had a horrible life, actually. I mean, both of his parents were dead at the time he was 15. His older brother, who was 18, was given legal responsibility for the children and was already a raving alcoholic. Well, he wound up homeless, and the other two kids wound up homeless. And Joe, to get out of the cold, would go into the library and read books, and that's when he started reading poetry. Anyway, in the midst of this evening, at some point he said in the conversation, "I need to believe in grace." And I just thought, what? You know, someone who had such a brutally hard life still could say, you know, or maybe you'd say because he had such a brutally hard life, I'm not sure. But just him sitting there and saying it stuck with me for a very long time. And this poem started out as a direct address. It's called Grace. The first line is, "You say you need to believe in grace." But as soon as I started writing it, it became just a poem about something quite different, I guess, in a way. Because Joe and I have a lot of similarities in our family. I don't mind the poem. We have a lot of similarities in our background. It's called Grace. You say you need to believe in grace. But what capricious ghost would spare you only to witness those it would not save? And why you? Why you and not the brother in the other bed or the father kneeling on his chest, seething, "Stop crying or I'll kill you." You hid beneath the blankets, begging God's protection. Is that why it's not you drinking himself to death? How arbitrary it seems that there are lives, well, moments, graced with happiness. That first sip of a particularly good cup of coffee on the first September morning that actually smells like autumn. Sanctus. And as you step into the season, you are accosted by someone drunk, schizophrenic, someone whose synapses seem dangerously misaligned. When did you learn to never even look at such people, but to actually touch one by the hand? What does it cost you? 27 cents to have him bless you, bless your heart, your day. And you do somehow feel blessed and begin not quite to pray. There, but for the grace of. An old woman, arms and legs spread against the flow of sidewalk traffic, is screaming for the life of a fallen sparrow, flopping on one wing. What is the meaning of what placed her there? You don't know what you believe, only that you don't understand. And what comfort is that? You must believe in something, if only in mercy. You don't know what God believes. Thank you.